Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Today's topic is one that will probably be of interest to everyone, for the simple reason that everyone does it. I'm talking about sleep, something that quite a few people at some stage of their life worry about. Are they sleeping deeply enough? Are they sleeping long enough? Or even too much? These are matters which have been researched by Professor Dirk Jan Dyke, Professor of Sleep and Physiology at the University of Surrey and Director of the Surrey Sleep Research Centre. Now, his current research interests include the contribution of sleep to brain function, the role of circadian rhythms in sleep regulation, the negative effects of sleep loss, and understanding age and sex-related differences in sleep physiology. And he's developing tests as well to monitor sleep, a very basic aspect of the field. So, Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's begin with the basic sort of underlying idea of all of this crucial concept, the circadian rhythm. What exactly is it?
A circadian rhythm. It's pretty clear that organisms evolved in a periodic environment. After all, the Earth rotates around its axis, and furthermore, the Earth also rotates around the Sun. And these rotations are associated with changes in the environment. Obviously, it's dark at night and light during the day. It's colder during the night compared to the day. And that means that if organisms want to function optimally and make use and anticipate these changes in the environment, maybe it's good for them to have an internal clock that tells them how many more minutes to go before the sun rises. And these internal clocks are present in almost all living systems. It's easy to understand that if you are a plant and you're doing photosynthesis, that's a good idea to have your leaves up during the day to catch as much light as possible. Whereas when it's dark, why keep your leaves up and why not just put them down? And plants and animals and other organisms indeed have evolved internal mechanisms that generate time. And these periodic changes in their physiology and biochemistry helps them to be prepared for changes in the environment and function optimally.
And just listening to you there, it just occurred to me, is the circadian rhythm the same across all cultures, human cultures? You say different species and so on have it, but amongst humans, is it precisely the same amongst all humans?
So characteristics of those circadian rhythms are, for example, the endogenous frequency or the endogenous period. When we study humans or other organisms in constant conditions, so in constant darkness or in constant light, we can observe that these clocks aren't precise in the sense that the period isn't exactly 24 hours. In most humans, that intrinsic period is slightly longer than 24 hours. But that aspect of circadian rhythmicity is present in all cultures. Of course, there are differences in sleep timing in the sense that in some cultures, people may get up slightly earlier than in other cultures. But humans are diurnal animals, and humans will be mostly active during the daytime in all cultures.
I'd like to ask, if I can, about the nature of sleep through a life cycle, if you like. So just starting with babies and ending up with, you know, something you've studied, elderly people. So let's start with babies. Babies need lots of sleep, right?
Babies sleep a lot. They may sleep up to 16 or 18 hours. And the question is, why do babies sleep so much, or why does sleep change across the lifespan? As we grow older and we become toddlers and children, sleep duration changes. And maybe a child age 10 or 11 years old may sleep something like 10 or 11 hours. So that's already less. But there is more to age-related changes in sleep than just sleep duration. Sleep can be subdivided in two different stages or two different states: non-rapid eye movement sleep and rapid eye movement sleep. And as the name says, during rapid eye movement sleep, there are rapid eye movements, and these are absent during non-REM sleep. But there are other differences between those stages. But in very young humans, there is a lot of rapid eye movement sleep. And the contribution of that sleep state to total sleep time becomes less as the brain matures.
If I asked you why that happens, that rapid eye movement sleep diminishes in its duration, would you be able to answer that, or don't we know?
I think that the hypothesis about the contribution to rapid eye movement sleep is in particular in the context of brain development. The human brain isn't mature when we are born. Many aspects of brain function and brain connections still need to be developed, and it is believed that rapid eye movement sleep plays a very important role there. In general, one hypothesis about the function of sleep is that it is important for brain plasticity. So it contributes to the brain being able to respond or change in response to waking experiences. Of course, a young brain will receive a lot of new information. A young brain needs to learn an awful lot about its environment. A young brain also still needs to learn a lot about how the rest of the body connects to the brain, how to move your legs and how to move your arms and how to learn how to walk. And for this, there need to be extensive feedback mechanisms between your limbs and your brain. And rapid eye movement sleep, for example, is thought to be quite important for coordinating those kind of feedback mechanisms between the brain and the arms and the legs. So that is one reason why we think there is so much REM sleep early on in life, and in general, why there is so much sleep early on in life.
You mentioned 10 and 11-year-olds. Getting on to teenagers, many parents will know it's difficult to get them out of bed in the morning. And there are those who say bucket of cold water, and those who say let them sleep. What's the science of adolescence and their need for sleep?
That's a very interesting and very relevant area. In the first instance, if we look at sleep physiology, I mentioned there is non-REM sleep and REM sleep. Within non-REM sleep, one can distinguish between very deep non-REM sleep or slow wave sleep and slightly lighter non-REM sleep or N2 sleep. As we enter adolescence or puberty, we see that there will be less of that very deep sleep. There will be fewer of these slow waves, or their amplitude will reduce. And one may wonder, how is this reflected in changes within the brain? We know that during adolescence, puberty, there are quite impressive changes in the number of synapses, so the connections between the neurons in the brain. These reductions are occurring primarily during that particular period in development, and that is associated with changes in the amount of deep sleep you can observe when you do an electrophysiological recording of sleep. So it is clear that there are biological changes, neurophysiological changes in the brain during adolescence and puberty. So that's one thing, but that relates to the structure of sleep and not necessarily to the timing of sleep. It is true that in all cultures, during this period, later sleep is commonly observed. This may actually have something to do with those changes in sleep structure, but it is also often hypothesized that it has a lot to do with changes in those circadian rhythms. It is true that when we assess the time of internal clocks, they will drift a little bit later during adolescence. And yes, it is difficult for those kids to get out of bed. So yes, there is a biological effect. We believe, however, that those biological effects are very much exacerbated by environmental factors. One good way to delay your clock or slow down your clock is by being exposed to light in the evening. And obviously, it is true that certainly nowadays, adolescents like to be on their phone, have a lot of screen time. So we here see this interaction between the environment and biological changes. And it's that interaction that is causes those extremely late sleep patterns in adolescents. And researchers have compared those changes in different cultures or in environments in which there was access to electric light and in environments where people didn't have access to electric light yet. And indeed, you see that in those environments or in those cultures with easy access to electric light, those delays in sleep timing are more pronounced. So that is, in essence, what is happening. So it certainly isn't just laziness, but it's also not true that one cannot do anything about it.
Right. So this is not a parenting podcast, but you're from what I'm gathering, you're saying less screen time in the evening, and if adolescents need a lie-in, they need a lie-in.
Yes, I think that is one a good way to go about it. It's important, I think, to point out that our understanding of how the light environment interacts with the biology in the regulation of sleep timing is now so advanced that one can indeed, and people have constructed mathematical models that can simulate those kind of changes and can predict the effects of interventions. In this context, there is a lot of discussion about school start times and shouldn't we start schools later? Obviously, it's not easy for an adolescent to get up before dawn to catch a school bus to be at school at 7:30 or 8 in the morning. So there is an argument for delaying school start time somewhat. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be very sensible to not start school until 11 o'clock in the morning, because then the children and the parents and the teachers would all be living on very different social schedules, which obviously has disadvantages as well.
Let's move on. We've talked about adolescence. As people get into middle age, it's often said you need 8 hours. Some people say 7 hours. What's the story about middle age?
Well, how much sleep do we need, and when are we an adult, and by when do we need 8 hours? I teach students, and now and then I ask them, how long do you sleep? And many people in their early 20s will say that they sleep 8 or 9 hours. So I think people in their 20s shouldn't believe that from a sleep perspective, they are real grown-ups. They may still need a little bit more than 8 hours of sleep. By the time you're in your 30s, 7 to 8 hours is probably a healthy sleep duration. If one reads the epidemiology and looks at associations between sleep duration and health, or sleep duration and adverse health outcomes, then a number of 7 and a half hours often pops up. So rather than 8, 7.5 seems to be, when we look at the average adult middle-aged person, to be a good sleep duration.
And as people get older, they tend to sleep less, I think. I mean, that's my anecdotal observation. Is that true? And, what's going on there?
Yes, that is another important area. How much sleep do we need when we are older? What can I expect about sleep and for example, my daytime sleepiness? We looked into this quite extensively, and I can describe you an experiment where, you know, we take people in their 20s, tell them to be in bed for 8 hours for a couple of weeks, and then we bring them to the laboratory. We do the same with people who are in their 60s, and in the laboratory, we record their overnight sleep. We observe that the older people have less deep sleep. Their sleep may be less consolidated, less continuous, and more fragmented. And then during the day, we ask the people to take a nap. Actually, we ask them to take 5 naps. And then we can measure how long it takes to fall asleep. And this is called a multiple sleep latency test. And in a way, that is a gold standard for sleepiness. If you haven't slept, you obviously fall asleep very rapidly and your sleep latency is very short. Now, when you do these experiments in young and older people, you observe the following. The latencies to sleep onset during the daytime are much shorter in the younger people compared to the older people. Now, it's important to point out that these older people are really healthy older people. We screen them extensively. They have no diabetes or no cardiovascular disease. But those healthy older people are less sleepy during the day than the younger people, even though their sleep at night is less deep and their total sleep duration is shorter. And that suggests that older people indeed may need less sleep and can be more alert. Now, one important implication of that finding is that older people should not expect to be sleepy during the day. If they are sleepy during the day, then this may be because they have a sleep disorder, like sleep apnea, where people stop breathing repeatedly during the night, or they have another medical condition. Daytime sleepiness is not a normal consequence of healthy aging. So that's one piece of data that suggests that older people need less sleep. And indeed, if you ask older people how long they sleep, they will sleep slightly less than, let's say, a person in their 30s. And one particular change is that they will wake up earlier in the morning. One can do other experiments to investigate those age-related changes in sleep need. One experiment we did quite a few years ago back in Boston at the Harvard Medical School was we took younger people and older people, and after a few baseline nights, they were asked to stay in bed for 12 hours at night. And in addition to these 12 hours in bed at night, they were instructed to be in bed for 4 hours during the daytime. Okay, and we did this for approximately a week. And now you can see how many hours of sleep younger and older people can get. In a way, one assesses the maximum capacity for sleep. And that maximum capacity of sleep was approximately, if I remember correctly, 1.5 hours less in the older people compared to the younger people. So indeed, the need for sleep, or in this experiment, certainly the maximum capacity for sleep, was very much reduced.
There are so many questions that arise from what you're saying. I mean, I'm surprised it's only 1.5 hours amongst older people, because observing elderly relatives, they seem to sleep 4 or 5 hours when they're getting, you know, really towards the end of their lives. But you're saying more normal would be, you know, 6 or something like that.
But remember, in the experiment I just described, people were instructed to be in bed for 16 hours out of 24 hours. which is somewhat different than the situation most older people will find themselves in. But nevertheless, there is this clear difference in sleep capacity. You can push it a little bit further and say, okay, if that is true that older people need less sleep, are they then better at, you know, pulling an all-nighter? What happens if you ask younger and older people to stay awake through the night into the next day, and you now assess how they perform during that sleep deprivation? And I haven't done these experiments. Other people have done those experiments and have observed that older people, then their performance is less affected than the performance of younger people. So that's another indication that older people need less sleep and are more resilient with respect to the negative effects of insufficient sleep.
That's very, very interesting. I must admit, I'd have thought the opposite would have been the case. That's fascinating to hear that older people can manage an all-nighter better than a younger person.
Certainly on the measures that were being used in those experiments, that is true, and that has been reported by a number of laboratories.
Now, you've done research on dementia and sleep, so let's bring that into the equation now. So we'll be talking generally about more elderly people, and let's say they develop dementia. What does that do to their sleep patterns?
The association between dementia and sleep is certainly of interest, and now being investigated by laboratories around the world. The first piece of information is that sleep disturbances and sleep disorders are a risk factor for dementia. Both very short sleep and very long sleep are associated with increased risk for developing dementia. There are certain aspects of sleep that are predictive of incident dementia. In particular, having less REM sleep is a predictor or is a risk factor for cognitive decline. I definitely need to mention here sleep apnea again. So if people suffer from sleep apnea, that is also a risk factor for dementia. So these data suggest that there is somehow a causal relationship between disturbed sleep and developing cognitive deficits. What the underlying mechanisms are is to the larger extent unclear, but several hypotheses have been proposed. By the time people become demented and people are living with dementia, their sleep is also disturbed. And there is a variety of sleep disturbances. One common aspect of those sleep disturbances is that people wake up frequently in the middle of the night and may wander around the house. So it's not just waking up to go to the bathroom, but it is much more. Another common observation is that people with dementia may spend very long periods in bed during the night. They may not sleep continuously during this long period, but in terms of hours spent in bed, that is certainly increased compared to cognitively intact older people. And then there are the excessive daytime naps, the very long daytime naps, and the daytime sleepiness, which is also a common feature in advanced dementia. So the sleep-wake system becomes dysregulated, the sleep-wake cycle becomes fragmented. Of course, this may be a consequence of changes in brain structures that are affected by dementia, and these brain structures may normally generate a normal sleep-wake pattern. And from that perspective, it's not so surprising that sleep, just as cognition, becomes disrupted in dementia.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And just spooling back a bit, before we talked about dementia, there's one thing you mentioned I meant to pick up on, which was sleep in the day. Because I think quite a few people, maybe you tell me if I'm wrong about this, just in their normal lives as they get older, tend to nap in the afternoon a bit, after lunch maybe. Is that, I think from what you were saying earlier, that's not an altogether good thing. It'd be better to stay awake.
So napping during the daytime, and whether this is the most natural thing to do, whether it's more common in aging, can be discussed from various angles. Let's start with the siesta. If we are in Mediterranean countries, people will talk about the siesta culture and from that conclude that it is natural to take a nap in the afternoon. We need to realize that in those cultures, environmental temperatures are very high during the daytime and in particular in the afternoon. And that certainly that in rural cultures where people had to work on the fields during the summer, it probably wasn't very pleasant to be out there when the outside temperature is 35 degrees. We will see what happens with global warming. A natural thing to do then is indeed to avoid the warm temperatures in the afternoon, go inside and take a nap. What else to do? We see that in those cultures, a lot of activities then take place in the cooler evening hours and that bedtimes are much later. The siesta isn't common in those countries where environmental temperatures are lower. So I don't believe that taking a nap in the afternoon is necessarily a biological phenomenon. So what about aging? Do we nap more with aging? One of the reasons we may observe more naps in aging is that many older people, of course, are retired and don't have to necessarily work their office hours. And that's why sometimes we may see more naps in older people. So it is, to some extent, probably related to changes in the social constraints, if you want to. When people start taking very long naps during the day, and we look at the epidemiology, then in general, that is associated with adverse health outcomes. So it certainly isn't a sign of health when people take two-hour naps in the afternoon.
Right. Now, then I'd just like to know a little bit about how you got interested. I mean, it's such a fascinating topic. And yet, I don't know when serious scientific research on it started. Maybe towards the beginning of your career, would that be right? How did you get into this?
I studied biology at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. At the University of Groningen, there was a lecturer, Serge Dan. And Serge Dan was a chronobiologist, and he had trained with some of the founding fathers of modern chronobiology, Jürgen Aschoff in Germany and Colin Pittendrick in the States. And I took a course of Serge Dan, and I was fascinated by biological rhythms. It had nothing to do, or very little to do, with sleep. It was all about biological rhythms in animals and in plants. And one of the reasons I was very much interested in it, because I liked the fact that biological phenomena could be described by, you know, using a concept derived from physics or oscillator theory, and that you could use words like entrainment or phase response curves or intrinsic frequency. So I did this course, and then after I graduated, he was awarded a grant to test a model of sleep regulation. And that model of sleep regulation was called the two-process model of sleep regulation. And that model was developed by him, Serge Dan, but in particular with Alex Borbély. Alex Borbély is a famous sleep researcher in Switzerland. And they had developed that mathematical model together with a physicist. And the Dutch science organization said, okay, here you have a PhD studentship, so you can test that model. And I was selected to be that PhD student and was supervised by the biologist Serge Dan, a physicist Domien Beersma, and a psychiatrist Rudy van den Hoofdakker. And you may say a psychiatrist. There's a lot of interest in sleep disturbances and sleep abnormalities in psychiatry, because in mental health conditions, sleep is often disturbed. So this is how I got into sleep and circadian rhythms. And that was back in 1983. And I guess we are here now 38 years later, and I'm still doing the same thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned a grant early on then. And you know, all academics now are besieged by people telling them they need to get grants. And it just occurred to me that your research is so relevant to the real world. I mean, there must be so many companies and militaries and all the rest of it who need to understand sleep. I think you've got a big grant, or I don't know, it was big, a grant from the US Air Force, because they need to know how long pilots can fly for, right?
Well, the US Air Force is one funding organization very much interested in sleep, circadian rhythms, and fatigue. One wouldn't like to see pilots fall asleep in the cockpit, and especially if these pilots have to fly through various time zones, fly at night, don't get enough sleep. And so, yes, indeed, we have been working with the US Air Force. I've also been working with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, looking at sleep in astronauts. Obviously, pharmaceutical companies are interested in developing new compounds, new hypnotics to improve sleep, or new compounds to improve waking function, or compounds that can change the timing of those circadian rhythms. And sleep and circadian rhythms are very relevant, especially in a 24/7 society where approximately 20% of the workforce is in shift work, which obviously requires you to be awake at night and sleep during day. So the relevance of sleep-wake research and circadian rhythm research to society is pretty obvious. It's interesting to see that, you know, in the course of my career, I've seen a growing interest, not necessarily from those companies and organizations, although that has happened to some extent as well, including the government, but the interest in the science community, the interest in the neuroscience community in sleep has increased tremendously. And neuroscientists wonder, you know, why do we actually have to sleep? Why does the brain have to go to that state, and what is happening during that state? And there is a little bit of a mystery still there, and it's very rewarding to see that now neuroscientists at all levels, from the behavioral neuroscientist to the molecular neuroscientist to the maybe theoretical neuroscientist, sleep is a credible subject for scientific study.
And can you tell us about one claim anyway about the importance of sleep research into sleep in relation to the Falklands? Weren't some quite bold claims made about that, the military campaign with Britain and the Argentina? Yeah.
I have been told stories without naming names that a sleep researcher involved there gave the advice about which hypnotic to take at which time when the troops were on their way to the Falklands and to best overcome the effects of jet lag and different time zones, etc. Maybe this particular sleep researcher was taking some probably well-deserved credit and was demonstrating the practical importance of managing sleep and in a way that is what it's about. How can we manage our sleep patterns under conditions in which it may not be so easy to sleep? And, you know, the battlefield is one so situation, but shift work is another situation. And of course, there are many parents of very young children who will say having a baby is probably the most challenging situation in terms of managing your sleep patterns.
Yes, I was in a cafe this morning watching a young couple with a baby. They looked absolutely exhausted. So I see what you're saying. I mean, when you look back, can I ask you, at your career, 38 years, it's a long, long time. And you've, when reading your biography, you've done, you know, a lot of different areas of research in this. What is, as you look back at your career, the most surprising thing you've discovered? What, when you started 38 years ago, did you not expect that you'd have become aware of?
One of the most surprising findings was about how that circadian clock regulates sleep-wake timing. If you were to ask people, how do you think a clock regulates sleep timing? You would probably say, well, that biological clock acts as an alarm clock. It wakes you up in the morning by giving some kind of strong wake-up signal. And then at the end of the day, it probably gives you a very strong, please go to sleep signal. It turns out that that's not the case at all. Actually, if you measure the signal coming from the biological clock, the signal that drives wakefulness, that signal is strongest in the evening hours. From a biological clock perspective, we are most awake in the evening. If you measure the circadian drive for sleep, that actually turns out to be strongest at approximately 6 o'clock in the morning, just before we wake up. And you may wonder, you know, why is that? That sounds quite paradoxical. When you come to think about it, it may be as follows, that of course your tendency to go to sleep will increase if you are awake longer and longer, in the same way as you're becoming more hungry if you have been fasting for longer and longer. So there must be some kind of a signal that keeps you awake, and if you want to stay awake for 16 hours. And it makes sense that that signal becomes stronger as the wake duration or the day progresses. And that's why we think there is this strong circadian signal in the evening, which is a very robust finding. And there were data in the literature that hinted at that, but people couldn't understand it. It was too paradoxical. And I think to elucidate that aspect of how the clock regulates sleep-wake timing was maybe one of the most surprising things I found. There were other surprising things. Some of them were maybe more trivial. I can give you the example that if people ask you, what's the largest effect or the strongest effect of not getting enough sleep? How does it change your brain or your behavior? The answer I'm going to give you is the largest effect is on sleepiness. If you don't get enough sleep, the first thing you will notice is you are sleepy. And people start laughing and would say, well, what's that? Isn't it true that your executive function or your memory is impaired? And we and others have looked at that in great detail. But no, the largest effect is on something as simple as sleepiness. And that's a useful piece of information, because when somebody asks me, doctor, how do I know whether I get enough sleep? I say, well, are you sleepy during the day? Yes or no? If you are sleepy during the day, you may not get enough sleep. If you're not sleepy during the day, then I think you're doing fine.
And when you look ahead at the future of this field, where do you think the important work lies? What are the front lines of this research?
There are probably two front lines. One front line is to think about sleep as a whole body phenomenon. It is not just the brain. It is also the body. It's the heart, it's the liver, it's the pancreas, it's your muscles. And one of the front lines will be to understand how rhythmic functions in all of those parts of the body, both the brain and the rest, are coordinated, and how that coordination will contribute to restful sleep. And obviously circadian rhythms and circadian clocks are present everywhere in the body, do play an important role in that synchronization and that coordination between the brain and the body. And understanding that integration, I think, is going to be one of the front lines in for understanding the contribution of health and the contribution of temporal organization of physiology to health. And data science and mathematical modeling and all kinds of sophisticated analysis techniques to describe dynamics will probably play a very important role there, especially since we know that those rhythms and these effects of sleep extend, you know, from the level of gene expression all up to the level of physiology and behavior. So the multi-level analysis of time and rhythmicity is going to be an important front line. The other front line will probably be in the area of sleep enhancement. Can we come up with interventions that will truly improve sleep? We have interventions that can make us fall asleep, like hypnotics, but I don't think that those interventions really enhance the power of sleep. But we're probably going to see techniques that can interfere with brain oscillations, that can interfere with specific brain structures implicated in the generation of sleep. And those interventions will probably ultimately lead to more powerful sleep in, for example, aging, where sleep may be less powerful. And by enhancing sleep, we may be able to counteract some of the effects of aging, for example, which may be mediated by changes in sleep.
Gosh, well, that's a very big suggestion, isn't it? That you could actually affect the aging process.
Yes, of course, this is for now all speculation, but it's certainly true that cross-sectional, if you look at indicators of aging and you look at indicators of sleep, there are clear associations.
Well, Professor, it's been very interesting indeed, and I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.